You're listening to the Charge Forward audio blog by Chargebacks911, bringing you the latest in payments and fraud. To learn more about how Chargebacks 911 can help you reduce chargebacks and recover revenue lost to fraud, visit us online at chargebacks911.com.
This episode is a replay of a webinar entitled, Why Your Customers File Disputes. Learn what the latest research says about cardholder intent and features experts from Chargebacks 911. Listen as they explore the findings of the 2024 Cardholder Dispute Index.
All right, let's go ahead and get rolling. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come and stop by our first webinar of 2024. I know you guys are muted, but I'm assuming there is applause going around. My name is Justin Clements. I'm the Director of PR and Media Relations over here at Chargebacks 911. I'll be more or less your host today for the webinar. Today, we're going to be uncovering some of our key findings from our recently released Cardholder Dispute Index, or CDI, as we'll probably call it for short throughout the webinar. I just want to real quick just kind of give the layout of some of these webinars. I know I see some folks in here who are repeat attendees, but for those of you that are new or this might be your first one, I just want to go over how this is structured. So first part of the webinar is going to be a short presentation. This portion, we're going to have some visual elements, some graphs, a lot of info. So it's important that if at all possible, that if you can close any of your other windows, just give us your undivided attention. Those graphs are really going to drive home some of the key points that we have for you guys today. The second portion that we'll have a very quick Q&A at the end where we're going to answer some pre-submitted questions, some live questions. If you have any questions during the webinar, please feel free to submit those. We'll try to get to those. If for any reason that we're unable to answer those questions submitted during the webinar, we'll definitely be sure to follow up via email and get those questions answered for you. All right, so today, we're going to, like I said, be breaking down the 2024 Cardholder Dispute Index. Joining me today to sort of give me a boots on the ground perspective, since we'll be up in the air looking at some of this overarching data, is Harlan Hudson. He's our Director of Strategic Partnerships. So thank you very much, Harlan, for joining us.
Glad to be here.
All right. So we're going to hop right into it. So just taking a look at what exactly the Cardholder Dispute Index is. We surveyed more than 4,000 consumers. This survey was designed to get their views, behaviors, some practical use cases for chargebacks and why they file them, as well as just transaction disputes in general. The consumers that we surveyed, they're evenly distributed across all the U.S. regions, various incomes, genders, all evenly distributed. So we tried to get a very accurate snapshot of the average American cardholder. So all these consumers that have surveyed, the qualifying question was having at least filed one chargeback within the last year. This presentation is going to be kind of broken down into four different parts. Part one is going to be, you know, who is the average cardholder? Let's get a snapshot of who these folks are, their preferences and different behaviors. Second part, we'll dive right into their satisfaction with the chargeback process, maybe indications of why they feel comfortable with filing a chargeback, as we see, you know, some folks are more privy to go to their financial institution than they are for merchants. The part three, this is going to be very important. We're going to be looking at chargeback triggers and why these consumers are filing these disputes. And then part four, we're going to kind of break down the total cost of chargebacks and maybe some best practices for merchants on what they can do. So let's dive into part one, which is who is the average cardholder? So through this survey, we were able to find that the average U.S. consumer today owns 5.5 payment cards. Now, this includes your bank credit cards, retail store cards, debit cards, prepaid cards, all of those that are eligible for chargebacks. Now, this 5.5 average payment card that they own, pre-pandemic levels was around 4. So we've seen that since the pandemic, with that huge shift to online shopping and e-commerce, that these consumers have, you know, opted for more cards and more payments using payment cards. Taking a look at the preferred way to pay, we can see that 80% of those that we surveyed prefer to use credit or debit cards. So while there are alternative methods of payments that are, that you're seeing a rise on, all around, debit and credit cards are still the king as for consumers and how they prefer to pay. So now just taking a look at online banking and how that's sort of making a big rise. We're seeing that, you know, just divided among age group. All right, who prefers to use mobile banking as opposed to going in face to face and meeting with a teller? We see that those under the age of 35, 72% are more likely to use mobile banking. Those 35 to 54 years old, more than half of them prefer to use mobile banking. And then you have the older generations who are, you know, more apt to, you know, going to their bank in person or opting out of using mobile banking. So we kind of see that those, you know, the demographics of those who are shopping, you know, from 18 all the way up to age 54, we see that, you know, the majority of them are preferring mobile banking for its ease and convenience. Taking another look over here at, you know, the buyer satisfaction with the chargeback process, right? So if you're a merchant on the call today, it's, you know, it's, you're probably very much well aware that consumers are finding it much more convenient to be going to their banks to dispute transactions as opposed to going to the merchant themselves to solve any dispute. And we've got some alarming statistics that we'll get into later on that sort of reinforces that. But just looking at how they prefer to file disputes, we see that from these responses that the vast majority of consumers prefer to dispute charges with their banks rather than the merchants. So this graph breaks down sort of the different methods of which cardholders prefer to communicate with their bank. And we see that most cardholders prefer to call their banks and speak to a representative. So even though online banking, we're sort of seeing a big transition into mobile banking and digital banking, we do see that the vast majority of folks still prefer to call their bank and talk to a representative, which from a merchant standpoint, if you're looking at your customer service departments, you know, this is sort of an indicator that, you know, consumers would much prefer to talk with someone over the phone for something that they're having an issue with, and obviously closely followed in, you know, second by going through their mobile banking app. So, you know, some of these banks have it to make it where you can dispute, you know, a transaction with just one click. So it's no surprise that we see that, you know, quickly following calling a bank representative is going through the mobile banking app. So while this just depicts relationships between cardholders and their banks, as merchants, we can take something away from this stat right here. In the survey as well, we're seeing that, you know, 91% of consumers say they trust their bank to correct any fraud issues that are brought to their attention, right? So we're seeing that banks are making it very much convenient, doing everything that they can to, if there's a fraudulent transaction or if there's any sort of dispute process, that they are making sure that they're doing right by their consumers. Now, the back end of that is sometimes we see chargebacks, even those that are illegitimate or invalid, are still getting pushed through by banks. But we see that, you know, with these cardholders, with how much trust that they have in their financial institutions, you know, the banks are looking out for their cardholders, and the cardholders, you know, subsequently are continuing to put more of their trust in their banks to solve any of these issues, even if it means not going to the merchant first. The following question that we asked consumers as well was, how often do you receive notifications about a particular transaction, even if it's confirming, you know, hey, was this you? Did you make this purchase? And the results might be surprising to some. They might be not surprising to others, depending if you get your own notifications from these banks. But we see that the majority of folks, about a quarter of them, a few times a year, will get a notification about different transactions. Sometimes we see, you know, around 10% get one once a month, about 15% get a few times a month, and around 13% get a few times per week. Something that the industry, a few folks in the industry have chalked up to what they call second party fraud. Sometimes when consumers make a purchase, and either it's a purchase that after the fact that they regret or have some sort of buyer's remorse, what happens is we see that these notifications can come in from these banks and unintentionally prompt issues of either first party fraud or misuse. So if that particular consumer is, you know, regretting a purchase that they made, and here comes the bank with a notification of, hey, was this transaction yours? Some consumers will reach out the bank and be like, you know, no, that wasn't me, and immediately initiating a chargeback, getting that immediate refund. So while the, you know, the banks are doing what they need to do to look out for their customers, but in doing so, we see that it can sometimes drive up the rate of first party fraud or misuse. just depending on where the consumer is at and what sort of purchase that they made. Also, one thing that we are finding from banks is how quickly that they're able to respond to disputes. That's further leading consumers to reach out to them first rather than the merchants. So one of the things that we see is with those quick responses, that nearly half of response reported seeing that their transaction was reversed by the end of the following business day, which, you know, in terms of merchants being able to keep up with chargebacks, it's a really quick turnaround time for those funds to be immediately pulled back and start that representment process. So we take a look at this. We can see about 20% reported getting that those funds back the same day. We see a little bit of an increase, around 23, 24% reported the next day, but around 40% is reported several days after. So just within several days of a dispute being raised with a financial institution, the majority of these consumers are getting that money back. Oftentimes initiating that chargeback sort of immediately, it kind of takes away any ability for the merchant to settle any of dispute on their own with the consumer. So one of the things that we often advocate for is being able to prevent chargebacks by receiving alerts if you're a merchant. So being able to see those dispute alerts coming in, and if it's something where a cause of merchant error or something that was preventable on the merchant side, where they can quickly refund for the product and avoid all the implications that come with a chargeback, such as the penalties, the fees, the ding on your merchant account, losing the product and the transaction value, all that is lost with a chargeback, right? And some of those extra costs could be avoided by going with a refund as opposed to a chargeback being filed. So this just tells you a little bit about the quick turnaround times and why consumers are more likely to rely on their banks rather than the merchants to sort of solve these issues. Taking a look at this on some more survey findings, we find that 80% of respondents reported being either satisfied or very satisfied with their experience filing chargebacks. Oftentimes if that chargeback is successful, right, that again, just reinforcing that dependence on the bank. But sort of the other stat that we were able to find that kind of tells you the lingering sort of the perception that consumers have when they file a chargeback and it's successful and they're very satisfied is that 87% are more likely to file a chargeback again, whether for valid or invalid reasons. So having them be comfortable with that process and the convenience that's provided with being able to file a chargeback with your bank and see those funds get refunded, practically instantly. We're seeing this level of comfortability of raising disputes, whether or not they warrant a chargeback. Again, these are just some of the, sort of the background info on who our cardholders are and why it is that they might be so comfortable with filing a chargeback. And obviously we see that there's ease and convenience with going to their bank. So that kind of takes the first two parts of kind of getting to know who it was that we surveyed, what they feel about chargebacks. Now, this next section, part three, we're going to kind of dive into why are these consumers filing these disputes that are turning into chargebacks? What's their reasoning behind it? We'll take a look real quick. So checking out these chargeback triggers, we can see that the leading cause of some of these disputes and how they raise unrecognized billing descriptors on their billing statement. Just taking a look at that, if you are a merchant and we're unaware how we're seeing, these transactions and how they appear on your billing statement, that's something that's sort of a leading driver for confusion and that can lead to disputes. So kind of looking back into why these buyers are filing these disputes, right? So the common problem, roughly a third of them said very often, someone often seeing those charges that they don't recognize on their statement. So being able to reach out to your merchant account provider and being able to have them, take a look at what that billing descriptor looks like and being able to change it, it's going to reduce that confusion that you're seeing that might lead to some folks filing a chargeback because they don't, either your billing descriptor is recognized by, it either has like the holding company or it doesn't have the business name that you're doing business as. So always good if you haven't taken a look at that or checked into that, seeing what those billing descriptors look like and seeing if it's something that might be confusing.
So let's just go back to the idea that people call their bank for a variety of reasons. You mentioned a billing descriptor not being recognizable. I think it's important to note that Every merchant should do pretty much a quarterly audit of their processes, including their descriptors. You know, in other words, does the descriptor have not just, you know, a name, but the name specific to the business that is being transacted on that particular merchant account or MID? If we think about billing descriptors, they might have the name of the corporation, say, that owns the MID, but it may not be the same as what the sales channel looks like, right? So it's important for you to understand that if you don't align it with what the consumer sees on the website, you're going to have problems. You're going to have people not recognizing what it is, and then they're going to call their bank. So that's a really important thing. And as you do a quarterly audit of these processes, it should include things like your terms and conditions, all that kind of stuff that will inform the client, or the consumer rather, as to what they can expect in the refund process, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we all know, I certainly am like this, I don't read every terms and conditions. I frankly read a lot of them, but I don't read them all. Sometimes I just click through. But it will be important if it does go to dispute. So when we think about how we manage our own interactions with the consumers, beginning with the first, you know, entry point. So they come in, they search for something, they look at something, we've got to be thinking about that communication. I hope that helps.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I know when we were looking at the number of folks who actually do take the time to read the terms and conditions, it's close to about 90% spend 5 minutes or less looking at terms and conditions, most of who don't even look at them at all. So you're not alone in that one, Harlan. All right. So moving forward about, you know, just what of these instances, like, can they be resolved with the merchant if they contacted them first? But unfortunately, we're seeing that 53% are contacting the bank as a first means to report a dispute rather than contacting the merchant. So even if it's something as simple as this product wasn't as described, or there might have been like a shipping issue, all of which could be resolved if you reached out to the merchant, but we're seeing because they're going to these banks as their first means of resolving that issue, that the merchant doesn't even have a chance to rectify that. So, you know, more than half of them going to their banks. It's kind of alarming, especially if you're a merchant wondering, how can I solve a problem if I don't know the problem exists?
Right, but keep in mind what we covered at in the early stages of the webinar. It's easy, it's convenient to go to their bank, right? The challenge level from a bank agent about the product or the service or whatever is very limited because they have no data, right? So somebody calls in, says, hey, I don't recognize this, or I didn't buy it, or, you know, I need a refund, whatever that is, they have no data to back up whether they deserve a refund, for example. So they're going to be very nice. They're going to say, well, gosh, Mr. Smith, I certainly am sorry for the inconvenience. Let me see if I can help you. The idea here is that there's going to be very little challenge to the consumer, the cardholder, on the part of the bank, because A, they'd have no data, and B, because frankly, the cardholder is their client. They want to make them happy. That's where they are invested. And mm-hmm. So it's not surprising that this convenience leads consumers and cardholders to determine, hey, if I need a refund, I'm just going to my bank, because they're not going to say, hey, you don't deserve a refund. They're just going to give me my money back, right? So this all ties into how easy it is to file a chargeback with your bank as opposed to going to the merchant.
Right. And even kind of taking a look into going into this next slide, we see that 72% of respondents who took the survey said that they view chargebacks and refunds as valid alternatives of one another, right? Equivalent processes. And I think one thing that highlights is sort of this educational gap that we see, right, with consumers not really understanding sort of those back end implications of a chargeback. Are they aware that this puts a ding on a merchant's account with their payment network? that there's a fine and a fee involved. If they go over a certain chargeback rate, a threshold, that they're going to have to pay more in processing fees, the operational cost that goes into tracking these chargebacks, right? It's not something that, according to these results, that consumer is necessarily even aware of. And it makes you wonder, okay, if they did know some of those implications, would they still, you know, if they knew that a chargeback was not the equivalent of a refund, would they still do it? Because, I mean, we probably have some merchants here on the webinar right now that, you know, dealing with these chargebacks and these costs, you know, this loss in revenue, well, where do you make up for that? Well, by raising the rates of your product or your services. So ultimately, you know, for some of these consumers, that cost for filing an invalid chargeback or an illegitimate chargeback is coming right back to them in the form of price increases. So it begs the question, if they knew that this was all happening on the back end because they chose to go to their bank rather than the merchant, would they still do it?
Yeah, I think it's an understandable sort of assumption, because they don't really know the process, they don't know the rules, and they don't really understand the cost. And so they rely on their bank heavily. I think the banks generally, not all of them, but generally, try when they can to ask the cardholder, have you talked to the merchant about this? I know I've filed one chargeback in my entire life, right? One. And it was on American Express. And the agent, I started out on the app. The agent that eventually interacted with me asked me that very pointed question, have you talked to the merchant? In this case, I had talked to the merchant. They were supposed to give me a refund. And many, 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 many days later, I still had no refund. So the idea here is that the bank should be taking responsibility to make sure that cardholder talks to the merchant first and doesn't just default to the bank. But sadly, I don't think every bank follows that rule.
Not, and I think there might be some consequences falling to these banks who fail to let their consumers know, because we also found that 87.6% of consumers reported wanting their banks to cancel subscriptions for them. So not only, you know, do they prefer not to contact the merchant first, they would rather their bank contact that merchant to cancel a subscription that they no longer want to have. You know, whether it's something that usually with these subscription-based services, it's recurring billing, something that they might forget about, or they started out with a free trial and then it turned into a monthly thing because they didn't, you know, read the terms and conditions or something like that. So this stat really stood out to me as far as how comfortable consumers are with filing disputes with their banks before they file it with the merchant. In fact, they want their banks to take an even a bigger position in resolving these disputes as being the one to contact the merchant and cancel those services. So this one really stood out to me and really drove home, man, consumers are extremely comfortable with having their banks resolve any dispute, whether it requires a chargeback or not.
Right. I think the problem with this, and so I know, I think it was Wells Fargo. I have a Wells Fargo card. And a few years ago, maybe even as many as 4 years ago, they came out with a service that was, they're going to manage all the, you know, monthly subscription billings, and they would cancel them, they would do whatever, right? So the bank is trying to provide a service, which in a way I get it. And I think it's a needed service, because we all have, it seems like, a million subscriptions, right? We got this music subscription and we got that thing and whatever. But what happens with a bank when you call about a subscription is that, let's say, for example, you agreed to a year subscription for iTunes, right? You agreed to that and you call your bank after the sixth billing, you know, cycle, right? The sixth rebill, and you say, hey, I didn't authorize this music service, whatever it is, didn't authorize it. And so what the bank does then, they say, well, you have five additional billing on this same at the same amount with the same merchant, why don't I get your money back on the one you're asking about, but then let me get the money back on all of them. Now, in most cases, the cardholder has agreed that they're going to do a year. That's number one. Number two, they've used the service for the period, at least the 5 months, if not the 6 month, with the billing cycle that's in question. And so what ends up happening is that the merchant, I believe, is wrongly charged back, and all of those billings are then refunded to the consumer while they had already used the service, right? That's mm-hmm. the problem. I personally don't have a problem with, okay, I got a billing that either is coming up, or I just had a billing, I noticed it, I want to cancel it. I don't know that I have a huge problem with a bank doing that then. What I have a problem with is all of the other disputes that they're going to file, from previous billing periods. So it's an interesting service, but with a chargeback, it becomes a bit more than that. And I think that's where the merchant needs to be engaged.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of going into, you know, we did follow up with those consumers off of this on, you know, why do you choose to go to your bank? You know, what is it about your bank and the services that they provide that drive a consumer to dispute a transaction with them rather than the merchant? And here's some of the leading causes that we found. You know, nearly half, or right at half, say that their bank offers faster solutions. So, you know, as a merchant, there is a competition for convenience that you have, that you're up against these banks in terms of, you know, trying to be there for your customer who is also their customer. So you're having to compete with their bank, which, again, but back to our previous slide of sometimes those refunds hit their accounts the same day. A lot of them do. So to go up against that from a customer service standpoint can be daunting and very much an uphill battle. Some of the other things that we see too are their bank is more understanding than the retailer, right? They're able to handle multiple transaction issues just on one call. Their bank requires less information than a retailer, which hopefully we start to see a little bit of a shift in that. We saw a little bit with Compelling Evidence 3.0 about, you know, some of the evidence that merchants are able to provide to help stop a dispute before it comes to chargeback if it is indeed illegitimate. And then lastly, we see, you know, they prefer to, less than 20%, probably around 17-18%, prefer to actually contact the retailer directly first. So you can see a very small portion prefer to reach out to the retailer because of all these different conveniences that they have. And unfortunately, it's a lopsided game for merchants for their customer service departments to go up against a cardholder's issuing bank.
Yeah, it's these are all things that, you know, have been pointed out in you know, sort of future slides or past slides, like, hey, they're going to do it right now. They'll put a provisional credit on that cardholder's account right now. The merchant is going to say, well, it's going to take, you know, 7 to 10 days. And so there's this kind of sense of, wow, this is faster. Now that credit is provisional in most cases, right? So it could be reversed, but the bank isn't telling their cardholders that, right? This understanding, like, yes, the bank's understanding because they don't have any information, as we've said. So all of these things lead to an entitlement mentality at the cardholder level that is really, really tough to break.
Mm-hmm. All right, so kind of taking a look at putting all this together, right, taking a look at some aggregate data, you know, so what we found was on average the U.S. consumer files 5.7 transactions per year, right? And we kind of see that there's a little bit of a disparity amongst men and women. We see women file close to 7, men filed, you know, just under 5, but, you know, right in the middle, 5.7. But we do see that women tend to file chargebacks more than men, just slightly more. But that's just from our survey results, sort of that disparity that we see as well.
Well, they women also do most of the shopping, right? So I think that that is that it's not really a disparity. It's just simply they're doing more of the going to the store, making purchases, clothes, whatever. And I think that that's where it comes from. But having said that, I think that there's also potentially some opportunity to figure out, well, who is our likely chargeback filer, right? And how do we better serve them? I think this all comes down to when we think about the banks being a better venue for them to go to get the refund, it's because they feel kind of safe. They feel it's convenient, it's easy, whatever. And the more that merchants can actually make it easier, a little safer, and I'm not saying easier to get the refund, I'm saying just a little bit less confrontational. And again, I don't mean that people are confronting, but I'm just saying this is kind of how we should be thinking about our customer service interactions. What are we saying when there's a problem with a recurring subscription? How are we presenting what we would like to do with that? If we're not going to give a refund, then what is the alternative? Or is there an alternative? Those kinds of things, because that can mean a lot to a cardholder who's upset, doesn't or confused, whatever that is, right?
Mm-hmm. So kind of taking all these things and compiling them together from what we found, we've looked at boiling down just exactly how much was charged back last year in 2023. So we can see from here that the U.S. Census has 193 million cardholders, right? And there's another industry report that was released this year said that 78% of Americans filed those chargebacks in 2023. And then from our own survey results, we're able to see that, the average chargeback, our average cardholder is filing 5.7 chargebacks and with an average transaction value of $76. So combining all of that together, we can see that there are $65 billion that was disputed in charges in 2023. And to kind of help, solidify that stat, we do see that almost $11 trillion was made in purchases using either credit cards, debit cards, or prepaid cards from some of the largest credit issuers. And all of those are eligible for chargeback protections, right? So just taking those, we, take the $65 billion in disputed charges and divide that by the nearly $11 trillion, we get a chargeback rate of 0.595%. And the industry average, according to multiple sources, is 0.6%. So the average merchant chargeback rate. So this figure, while it's a lot bigger than some of the estimates that we've seen, is kind of right on track with what we're seeing in the industry. And to take that a step further, so LexisNexis has this fraud multiplier, right? So, they say for every dollar that's lost to fraud in a transaction, it costs a merchant $3.75. And this is for, in terms of chargebacks, this is for, as I mentioned, those chargeback penalty fees, the loss of product, the loss of dollar value when those transactions are charged back, the operational costs, all those things equate to about $3.75 for every dollar. So if we take that $65 billion and some change and multiply that by 3.75, we're getting around like $243 billion in that true cost of chargebacks on the back end when you add everything together, which is an alarming figure and one that we hope just through education and talking with banks and more collaboration between card networks, merchants, financial institutions, that's something that we can effectively bring down. I know we've been seeing some major improvements and everything, but that number is still alarming.
I just want to comment on this. This is a little bit, and we used to have a graphic about this. It's the $65 billion is kind of it's like an iceberg, right? There's $65 billion that's above the water. You can see it. It's a tangible cost to this problem. The rest of it, that remaining, you know, 190, however many billion dollars that is, those are soft costs. They kind of reside under the surface, right? They're subterranean, so you don't really sort of have a very clear view on that extra money, but it exists and it creates tremendous amount of costs, whether it's to defend yourself against an invalid chargebacks, whether it's to replace the good because the good has now been shipped and gone, whether it's, you know, the marketing costs, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, those are costs that reside under the surface. And I think it's important for merchants to know. It's a stunning statistic, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Now, kind of taking all that into account, Harlan, you know, what would you recommend for merchants? Because obviously there's going to need to be some changes, and, you know, from the financial institutions end, for, you know, possibly educating the cardholder on some of those impacts. You know, the payment networks, we see that they're adapting their rules a bit to kind of address friendly fraud. But in terms of what, you know, any merchants that might be on the call and how and what they can do to help put a dent in this, what's some of the best practices, tips, what can they do?
Yeah, so we talked about just briefly early on that every merchant should go through their website, go through a buying process. You know, they search for an item, they put it in the cart, they go through the whole thing, they click on the agree button. And especially, this is especially true with recurring merchants, you know, that really important opt-in. Yes, I know this, I'm going to be billed every, you know, 10th of the month or whatever that is. The more that you can really begin on a regular basis, looking at your processes, looking at your descriptors, looking at the merchandising that you've done on your website, if you're a tangible goods merchant, to know that, hey, we actually do have red shoes in this style available. And so we will ship those instead of shipping something else, which leads to a chargeback. So go through the shopping process, do an audit. I'd say once a quarter is really important. Implementing chargeback prevention tools and measures. Yeah, the industry has become very, very adept at creating prevention tools that get ahead of the problem. And it used to be that they were just refund tools, which no merchant wants to refund any money unless you're just like, I don't want to do anything with chargebacks. But most merchants don't want to refund money, but sometimes it's the right thing to do. So there are refund tools like Ethica, Legacy Alert, Ethica Alert, CDRN from Verify. But now we're getting into tools like RDR, Rapid Dispute Resolution from Verify, which is an automated API refund tool that can be rules-based. Order Insight and Consumer Clarity and some of these other things, including acquirer collaboration, can really create an opportunity then to exchange data before a chargeback is initiated at the issuing bank level. And if you prevent it, then there's no statistics, no chargeback statistics that are going to hit your account. So it's these prevention tools are really important to take a look at. Look, open communication is always a thing. Being honest, I am a believer in more communication than less, especially after a consumer has made a purchase, whether that's a digital good, a recurring subscription, a tangible good. The more communication, email, text, whatever it is, that's going to help you. That's going to help build trust from the cardholder to you to come to you to get a refund or to express a problem than to go to their bank, right? We talked about how banks have the trust of consumers. Well, you as the merchant can build not that same trust, but you can build greater trust by communicating more frequently. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're in the third-party chargeback management business, so you certainly should consider that. But it's not just because we want to do, you know, more chargebacks and we're going to, you know, make money and all that. Those are, we're a company. We're in the business to make money. But, and I'm just talking about us, there are other companies out there, but for us, we know that we have more data on chargebacks. Why, what's the cause of the chargeback? You know, how can it be resolved most effectively, including should we prevent it with a refund or should we prevent it with something like Order Insight in a data exchange with the issuer? We have more data than any merchant on the planet. We have more data because we have a couple of million merchants that are on our platform. So we believe that there's a lot of value in that beyond just, oh, we're going to take that off your plate. No, the data can be helpful to you.
Yeah, and not to mention the rules for card networks, they change constantly. You know, at least twice a year are there major card rule updates for chargebacks and everything. And we see from our merchant survey that we do in our field report through the year that, you know, a lot of these companies who handle those chargeback management in-house, they put that responsibility with their finance department, sometimes with their customer service department to be able to look into those. But does your team have the capability or the time to stay up to date on all those rules and regulations? Because it's ever evolving. So you know, just when you're trying to assign that responsibility internally, that's something that you have to take into consideration too, is, you know, is, does that department or that person have the bandwidth to be able to stay on top of all the rules and regulations to help, you know, save you money and lost revenue. So yeah, that too. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the presentation portion. So as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, we're going to dive into the Q&A portion. A couple of these, we have some pre-submitted questions in here. So we got about 10 minutes left. We're going to jump right into these ones. So the first one comes from, and apologies, we've got attendees from all over the world. So if I mispronounce your name, terribly sorry. But this one comes from Jualmi. What are the best ways to reduce friendly fraud on non-refundable purchases, such as travel?
Yeah, I think that's really a great question. Travel is a very unique sort of use case in that a tremendous amount of the transactions are completely non-refundable, at least according to the terms and conditions and refund policies of the travel provider or the agent of the travel provider itself. So specifically the large online travel agencies like Expedia and Priceline and so forth. So it's very, very important that your refund policies, right, be very clear and right up front that, hey, this is a non-refundable ticket or hotel, you're purchasing this hotel room, it is non-refundable. I mean, being very upfront with that, again, being, you know, having all of the sort of disclaimers, the refund policy, all of that you need to have. And if you're in the travel business, you know how this works. Why is that? It's probably not going to prevent or reduce friendly fraud, but it is very likely going to be important. It will be important in the dispute process, whether you're talking about a pre-dispute workflow like Order Insight, where you're actually exchanging data. That refund policy is going to play into the decision as to whether the issuer says, I'm sorry, Mr. Jones, it looks like this was non-refundable. You clearly agreed to the terms and conditions of this ticket. We're not going to provide you with a credit. So it's very important to reduce friendly fraud a couple of different ways, being very upfront about the type of purchase this particular person is making. And if it's on travel, it's a non-refundable ticket, tour, hotel, whatever, but also to have all of your T's and C's and refund policies and all of that very tight, so that in the event that they do come back to you and they want a refund, you can make that happen. Now, The second part of that is customer service, right? Like, make it really super simple and easy for them to reach you. Have on your descriptor either a customer service number or the URL, the link by which they can reach someone at customer service to ask for a refund. I mean, if we had 10% more cardholders asking for refunds, that would be a tremendous uptick in the way that we could handle every one of these sort of friendly fraud cases. And what do I mean by that? You might offer them a voucher. Maybe there's another way to, you know, sort of work with the supplier, the hotel, and to get them a different date that they can come because they, you know, can't come on this particular date, whatever. Lots of ways, if you can just get them to call you or reach out to you, there's a lot of ways that the supplier, the travel OTA or the merchant, whatever, they could potentially help the cardholder, and that would avoid a friendly fraud call to the bank. And let's be clear, friendly fraud just is a cardholder not wanting to deal with the merchant. They know they're going to be told it's non-refundable, and so they call and tell their bank, hey, I didn't do it, or I don't recognize it, or whatever. And they know it. They know that they did it, and they're going to still call anyway. So there's lots of kind of best practices, but that's where I would start.
Yeah, I think those are great. All right, and then Harlan, I think this would be a great question for you too, just considering you're on the front lines of chargeback. When will MasterCard present something like Visa Compelling Evidence 3.0? And that comes from Elena.
Yeah, that's a good question. Of course, they've got acquirer collaboration, which is a bit of a, you know, sort of, it's a little bit of what they're trying to do here, which is to provide, you know, an opportunity for the merchant to become involved with the process and resolving it directly with the cardholder. But as far as something that's very specific like CE 3.0, I'm not sure when they're going to come out with that. Now, they are very much, I believe, working on that. They're, you know, I'm sure they're surveying the results that Visa is getting it, but getting from it. But Compelling Evidence 3.0 is a very, very, very interesting approach to basically binding certain elements and certain sort of activities to a cardholder so that they can hold them accountable, right? So in CE 3.0, if you have previous good transactions, and this is great for subscription merchants, if you have two previous transactions between 145 days and 365, or 140 and 365, you have two good transactions that did not go to chargeback, that is a huge indicator that you knew this merchant you'd purchased before, but then you bind that to an IP address at their location of the card or device identity, those kind of things. As you begin to get this compelling evidence block, then you have an opportunity to stop a dispute from happening through the data exchange rather than through the representment process. So I'm hoping that MasterCard will come out with something very similar to that, but they're a little slow on the uptake of that. So I don't have I don't have an answer, frankly.
No rumblings.
Yeah.
All right, perfect. Well, we're about 3 minutes to the top of the hour, so we'll go ahead and sign off here. I just want to say thank you for everybody for, again, taking time out of your afternoon to come and join us. All right, so thank you guys again. And just a reminder, this webinar was recorded, and we'll have a link at some point in the next day or so that you can share with friends, colleagues, post on social media, however you guys would like. Or if you guys want to listen to it again yourselves, take a look at the data, you can do that. Our 2024 cardholder dispute index is available on our website. If you go to Chargebacks 911, you can find it through there. If you type into Google 2024 cardholder dispute index, it should show right up. Go check out that report in full. There's a lot of information that we couldn't pack into an hour that's in there that we think will be really useful for you guys. And then after about 30 days, we'll have this webinar available on our podcast, Charge Forward with Chargebacks 911. It's available on all platforms. And be on the lookout for our next webinar that'll be scheduled to go out. Just stay in touch with us. We'll be sure to let you guys know when that is. And we will see you next time. Harlan, thanks again for hopping on.
You are very welcome. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care, everyone.